Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live once more this week. This is Friday. We are on every weekday at this same time, and we open our phone lines for you to call with your questions that you might have about the Bible or the Christian faith or about your own spiritual journey. We'd be glad to talk to you about those things that are on your mind. If you see things differently than the host does about certain things and you'd like to balance comment and bring up an alternate viewpoint, you're welcome to do that on our dime here. The number is toll-free. You can call right now at 800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Joyce, calling from San Diego. Joyce, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. Yes, my question is about the Bible. It's about some people said his name is Yahweh instead of Jesus, and back in his days, his name was that. It wasn't no J's back there in his day. So which is the correct? Is it Yahweh or what's his real name?
The name of Jesus, well, that depends on what language you speak. In the Hebrew language, in the Aramaic, which was spoken locally in Israel in the days of Jesus, you're right, those languages do not have a sound like our sound J. In the place of the J sound, they have a sound that would be like our Y. So instead of saying, anything that sounds like a J in English, they would have to have a Y sound there. Now, Yahweh is actually God's name, but in Aramaic, the name of Jesus would be Yahshua or Yahoshua. There are different forms of it. The point is that the word Jesus, or the name in Hebrew, actually means Yahweh is salvation. It comes from the name Yahweh and the word for salvation. In Aramaic, it would probably be pronounced something like Yeshua, Yahshua, Yehoshua, or something very similar to that. And there's actually people who have other pronunciations that they have suggested. Now, in different languages, things are pronounced differently, partly because in some languages they don't have the same sounds. For example, the name Yeshua in Aramaic or Hebrew would not be pronounceable in Greek, because the Greek language does not have an SH sound. And so when the Greeks rendered the name of Yeshua, they replaced the SH sound with an S. And so they had Jesus. Jesus is simply a Greek transliteration of the Hebrew Yeshua. Now, in English, although we do have the ability to pronounce the Y sound, somehow the pronunciation morphed into a sound, the sound J. So we say Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. So in different languages, these letters are pronounced differently. But of course, it wouldn't matter. God knows that we all speak different languages, and He doesn't. It's not an issue, I don't think, to God. Whether we pronounce it in the Aramaic way. I mean, Jesus isn't only for Aramaic-speaking people. He's for English-speaking people and Greek-speaking people and people of all languages. In Spanish, they'd say Jesus, because what we have as a J, the Spanish pronounces like an H, Jesus. So you've got Yeshua in the Aramaic, becomes Jesus in the Greek, becomes Jesus in English, becomes Jesus in Spanish. But they're all different forms of the same name as they would be pronounced in the different languages.
Oh, okay.
So just like the name John in English would be, in Spanish, be Juan. All right? So if my name was John and I was living in Mexico, I would not be surprised or certainly not upset if they would call me Juan, because that's the same name, only it's in their language. So Jesus is the same as Yeshua, only in our language. And so since we don't speak Aramaic, most of us, now, if we did, if we spoke Aramaic, we'd probably be calling him Yahshua or Yeshua or something like that. But God does not expect us to speak Aramaic. He knows we're English-speaking people. So I can't imagine that God has any objection to us pronouncing his name the way that the English language would.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to have you ask that question. God bless you.
Okay. Thank you.
I know. Okay, our next caller is Jonathan, calling from Tangent, Oregon. Jonathan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Talk to you again. I just have a question about 1 John 4:18. I just need some clarity regarding the part about whoever fears has not been perfected in love. And I've been struggling lately with just a lot of fears of death, and I nearly lost my wife 4 times last year, and then a friend too. I literally actually watched pass away, and I can't seem to get over my fear of specifically my wife nearly passing. It was pretty traumatic, but she's doing okay now. But
you almost lost her 4 times last year?
Yeah, she was diagnosed with cancer, and the Lord healed her from that. And then she has some problems with asthma, and there's just some complications that won't take the time, but there's just a lot of fears I specifically struggle with getting down to death's door with her, you know. And anyway, how do I trust God in that? And how do I don't know. I can take my answer off the air, that's better.
Or whatever you prefer, but is your wife a believer?
Yes, she is a Christian. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll be glad to address that question, both the scripture you raised and the general question, too. If you prefer to take it offline, that's up to you.
Yeah, just for the sake of your callers. But blessings to you. Really love your ministry and listen to your lectures and stuff all the time. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. God bless you. Thank you for calling. Now, with reference to 1 John 5:18, it says, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love. This is, in the context, I think this is not talking about fear generically. I don't think it's saying that if you, if North Koreans are sending missiles our way, and you know that your town's going to be blown up, that if you have some fear in that situation, that somehow you're not a very loving person, or you're not sufficiently loving. I don't think that's what it's talking about. What it's talking about is in a relationship with God. People either fear God or they love God. Many people serve God because of fear, and they do what he says because they're afraid not to do it. They're afraid of the consequences of disobedience. Now, what John is saying, well, we should love God, and as we love him perfectly, then such fear is removed. That is to say, we're not serving God out of fear. We're serving God out of love. And once we perfectly love God, we no longer do anything out of fear. We don't have fear as a motivation. I mean, it's sort of like some people are terrified of hell. And, they feel like, well, I don't really want to be a Christian, but I sure don't want to go to hell, so I guess I'll be a Christian. Well, they're serving out of fear, and it's clear they don't love God, because nothing would cause them to serve God if it wasn't for the fear of hell. Now, if you love God, well, as if you love anybody, you want to please them. Nothing pleases you more than bringing them pleasure. You love to give pleasure to someone you love, and therefore, if you love God, then you're delighted to serve him, and the fear is simply not a factor at all. For example, I have never given any thought to the question of hell as a motivator in my life in probably 40 years. And that's because I serve God because I love him. And now, maybe when I was younger, before I knew God very well, I might have served him because of fear of hell. But that has ceased to be an issue. Perfect love, the more we love God, and the more our life is governed by perfected love or improved love, because we do, it is there's measures of love. The more we perfect our love for God, the more that becomes the dominant or complete motivation of our life, the less there's any fear that motivates us. So John is not really talking about all fear in life goes away when you love enough, but it's saying that in terms of our relationship with God, it can either be fear or it can be love. And the more it is love, the less fear is even a factor at all. In fact, the fear goes away when you know the love of God, and when you love him, it's simply a fearful relationship doesn't exist anymore. And I think that's what John is talking about in the context of 1 John chapter 4. in verse 18. Now, as far as your fear of losing your wife, I can understand that. If I thought I was going to, well, from time to time, I think about losing my wife because I've lost wives before. I've had a wife that died when I was younger, and I didn't have any forewarning of that. She was killed in an accident. So it's not like I had living with a wife who was near death, knowing that I might lose her. She was young and healthy. She was 25 years old in perfectly good health. And then one moment she's there, the next moment she's gone. Now, I often think that if someone had told me the day before or the week before that she was going to die, when she would, that it would have maybe tormented me. I might have been tormented by the fear of that loss or the sorrow of it. But since it happened suddenly, and I had no forewarning of it, I just had to deal with it the way I deal with any other crisis that comes into a person's life. Just, trust God, accept from the hand of God what He chooses, and of course, the more you love God, the more that is your default attitude. If you love God, and He does something that pleases Him to do, but doesn't please you, well, still, the fact that you love God means, well, I can live with that. I can live with what God does. After all, my wife was a believer too, so I know she's in heaven. Your wife is a believer. Fortunately for you, she's not gone yet. But and you almost lost her four times last year. Now, let me just tell you this, and this is, I don't mean this harshly at all, but you'd better be ready to lose her, if not the cancer. I mean, if she was completely healed of cancer and of all her maladies, and she lived another, 30 years or 40 years healthily, still, at some point, she and you and everybody else in the world are going to die. We're all going to die. And this has got to be a reality we live with and that we can live with. We have to be able to live with that fact. When people said to me, were you angry at God when your wife? No, it never occurred to me to be angry at God when my wife died. I knew she was going to die. When we got married, I knew she was going to die. In fact, everyone I meet, I know they're going to die. Everybody's going to die. I have no idea when most people are going to die, and of course, when you're married to someone, you hope they don't die very soon. You'd prefer they wouldn't, but if they die soon or if they die late, you're going to grieve the loss. And there's no sense fearing what you cannot control. God is in control of such things. And if you love and trust God, you can say, God, I know you won't let my wife die if you want her to live longer. If you want her to die, it may be, certainly nothing I can do can prevent it, because I would prevent it if I could. But if you want her to go, it's apparently because you're taking her away from her suffering. And maybe from sufferings that I would, in the future, hope to be free from, too, that I don't know about. God knows the future. I don't. And people who die today, even prematurely, may be escaping something that's coming tomorrow that we don't know about, that God does. It says in Isaiah 57, verse 1, the righteous perishes, and no man takes it to heart. Merciful men are taken away, while no one considers that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. He shall enter into peace. They shall rest in their beds, each one walking in his uprightness. So when righteous people are taken away prematurely, it says people should be thinking, well, they're being taken away from the evil to come, and they're going to a place of peace. This is the Christian's understanding. I don't want the wife I'm with now, I don't want her to die. And frankly, if I'm being completely selfish, I hope I die before she does, because then I don't have to suffer the loss. On the other hand, that's not very unselfish of me, because I should probably wish that she wouldn't have to suffer the loss if it's going to be hard on her. It's, how do you choose such things? Well, the truth is you don't. Unless you commit suicide, which we're not allowed to do, you don't choose when you're going to die or when the people around you are going to die. But you shouldn't be afraid of death. The truth is that ever since God became more real to me than this world, and that's been since 1970, I've always looked forward to dying. There was a time in the 1970s where a man, a very hostile man, was said to have put a contract out on me. I didn't hear it from him. I heard it from someone who heard it from someone who heard it from him. And the man was truly a very hostile man toward me. And I heard that he put a contract out on me. Well, I don't know if he did. He probably didn't. But I didn't know that he didn't. He was certainly the kind of guy with the kind of connections, he could have done it. And so I lived every day for a while thinking, when I walk out of the house, there may be a guy in a car across the street or in an alley that I'm going to walk by who's been paid to kill me. Maybe I'll die today. Now, you might think that's a scary thing, but actually what it did for me was simply made me resign to the fact, well, today may be the day I go to see the Lord. I don't know. You never know. But to see the Lord is not a scary thing for me. That's where maybe perfect love casting out fear would be an issue. Are you afraid to see God? Are you afraid for her to see God? You shouldn't be. If the way I see it, we are separated from Christ in this body in the same way that, let's say, a woman is separated from her husband when he goes off to war and she's at home. You know, there's a separation there that neither of them are very happy about. And what they look forward to most is being reunited. And if she loves her husband, if her husband loves her, it's difficult for them to be apart from each other. And they cherish very little more than the idea of coming back together and being back at home together. And that's how it is if you love the Lord. You know, how could you want anything more than to see Jesus? Paul said in 2 Corinthians 5, we know that while we're present in this body, we're absent from the Lord. He says we're willing, yea, eager, to be absent from the body and present with the Lord. Paul said, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. Now, Christians know those verses, but I suppose it's one thing to know a Bible verse. Maybe you've known it all your life, and you've nodded your head like, yeah, that makes sense. That's a true statement. But then when it comes down to, do I really believe it? Is it really so? Am I really eager to be absent from the body and present with the Lord? Do I really believe that if somebody I love dies and they love the Lord, that they are happier to be away than here, that they are happier to be in the presence of Jesus than in the presence of, a President Clinton or President Trump or someone like that? You know, I mean, to tell you the truth, I'd rather be with King Jesus any day. And I don't know why anyone would actually choose to stay here if they had the opportunity. If Jesus came and said, well, I'm going to give you a choice. Do you want to stay on earth or come with me? I say, hey, that's a no-brainer. Let's go. And I've always, I guess I've had that attitude since I was, since about 16 years old, because Jesus is in fact real to me. I think if people don't have that attitude, I have to ask them, is Jesus really that real to you or not? And if he is, do you love him or don't you love him? If what you say you believe as a Christian is true, then that transforms everything about the prospect of death. In fact, when I was 10 years old, Billy Graham had a crusade in Los Angeles. That must have been around 1963. And I went there, and although I had gone forward at an altar call when I was younger, when I was four, I went forward at the altar call at the Billy Graham crusade again in L.A., and I remember distinctly why. Because when he gave his sermon, though I don't remember, of course, very much about his sermon specifically, just because it was so long ago, the thing that stuck in my mind was he said, because I'm a Christian, I don't have to be afraid to die. Now, to me, that's a very basic and obvious truth. But at 10 years old, I'd never given it much thought. First of all, when you're 10, you don't think about dying very often. And secondly, my Christianity was largely taught by rote from Sunday school and from my parents, and therefore I hadn't really thought through a lot of those issues. But when I heard Billy Graham say, because I'm a Christian, I don't have to die, that suddenly became a very, very, I knew that was true. And that became a very controlling concept. Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 that when he was in Asia, he was so persecuted that he despaired of his life. But he said he was put in this condition so that he might not trust in God, in himself, but in God who raises the dead. So, I mean, this is how Paul lived. This is how Christians in persecuted countries live. I feel terrible and very sympathetic for you with reference to your wife's sickness. When you have a wife who's suffering, her suffering must be a terrible trial to you every day just because of your sympathy for her. But the fear of losing her, I can understand that too. I don't know if you have young children, and they'd be bereft of mother, or I don't know if she's been a lifelong companion, you're not on the line anymore, so I can't get any more information from you. But the thought of losing your wife is a terrible thought. But it's not something to be afraid of. For one thing, you can't change it. You can't, You can't, by being fearful, change it. That's what Jesus said about worrying. He says, don't worry. You can't, by worrying, change, you know, one hair from white to black, and you can't add one cubit to your stature by worrying. In other words, Jesus is saying worrying isn't going to change anything. So whatever suffering you would have from the negative event you're worrying about, you will have it in any case, whether you're worried about it or not. What's more, you'll have more worry because you're suffering. You'll have more suffering because you're suffering it in advance. You know, like I said, when my wife was killed, I didn't know it was going to happen, so I wasn't worried about it. I suffered her loss. But if I had known or worried about her dying for a week or a month beforehand, I would have suffered her loss a lot longer. I would have suffered her loss before it happened. I'd be suffering it every day as I was worrying and being fearful about it. What's more, I would be doing so without the grace of God. That is, without this helpful grace of God, because God doesn't give you grace for suffering that isn't present. He gives you grace for present suffering. When my wife was killed, like I said, I would have gone crazy if you'd told me the day before that she was going to be killed. But when it actually happened, the grace of God was given to me in such a way that I knew the presence of God. I was given tremendous peace. And I was aided by the grace of God, because that's promised. The Bible indicates that God's grace is sufficient for us. But it's only grace to help in time of need. He doesn't give us grace to help before the time of need. So when you're worrying and fearing things that might happen, worrying and fearing them isn't going to not make them happen. And the truth is, if they end up not happening, then you suffered all that worry and fear for nothing, because it was not real, not reality. It didn't ever happen. But if it does happen, the thing you're worried about, well, then you've worried about it and suffered it much longer than you needed to. And that, prior to God giving you the grace that He would give you at the time of the trial. So, I mean, just learning to trust God, frankly, and to love God is the task that every Christian has. And it has a tremendous impact on fearing death. The truth is, if somebody broke into my house with a hatchet and was threatening to kill me and my wife, the sensation I would have would be fear, definitely. On the other hand, once that sensation had yielded to common sense, I would have thought, well, this is not the way I hoped to go, but who cares? I'm going. You know, if they're going to kill me and my wife, then I guess we're going to go see Jesus today. I could have chosen a less violent way, but whatever God chooses for me is fine with me. It's going to see Him that matters. Anyway, you may think I'm approaching this whole issue very cerebrally, whereas you're in a situation of great emotional stress with your wife's ill health and the fear you're fearing. But let's face it, you can't control your emotions, but you can think clearly. It's when we don't think clearly that our emotions overwhelm us. And so I'm just urging you to remember what you believe as a Christian, and to really believe it. And if you find that, you know, you don't really believe it, then that's where I would suggest, you know, like most Christians, we need to cultivate more faith, more love. We need to cultivate our relationship with God and not just let it be a religious conviction, but rather a personal relationship that governs our whole thinking about everything. I've spoken a long time about this because it's a major issue, but I want to talk to one more caller before out of time. Richard from San Diego, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Steve, first off, I want to thank you for the answer that you gave the guy previous on the question, because I just dealt with my brother's death a couple weeks ago, and I've been leaning on 2 Corinthians chapter 5 a lot, and that meant a whole lot to me just hearing that. So I think just me tuning in and listening has blessed me a whole lot just by listening to what you have to say there. My question that I had after that is probably, you know, it has to do with language. I started over reading Genesis again, and I was kind of confused a little bit because of the Tower of Babel. I thought that's when the languages were separated.
Yeah.
But it was saying also in chapter 10, verse 5, it also talked about when Noah's descendants were separated, that their languages were separated. So how many times were they separated? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay, they were separated only once, and that was at the Tower of Babel, which was in Genesis 11. The reason you're having confusion is because you're reading the chapter before that, chapter 10, and it says, from these, meaning the sons of Noah, from these the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his own language, according to their families and nations. So here it talks about people being separated by language differences, and yet this is chapter 10, and you don't read until chapter 11 about the Tower of Babel. But the reason is because chapter 10 is not a chronological narration. It's not narrating things that happened before the Tower of Babel. It's talking about where all the nations came from Noah's sons. Now, it was probably only two or three generations after Noah that the Tower of Babel occurred. But chapter 10 is looking forward many generations afterwards. This is simply telling the reader, where did the Egyptians come from, and the Assyrians, and the Babylonians, and the Ethiopians, and the these people from different lands, where did they come from? Well, they came from these sons of Noah, and eventually they're divided into their lands and by their languages. Now, if someone says, well, but where'd their language differences come from? Well, that's going to be told in the next chapter where it tells about the Tower of Babel. But this is not in chronological order. This is looking over the whole sweep of history beyond the flood through many, many, many generations where these nations came from. They didn't come in one or two generations from Noah's sons. Noah's sons couldn't have had enough children to have, probably in their lifetime even, to have, nations come from them. These nations developed over probably centuries, generations certainly, and centuries. So the division of these nations into different language groups actually occurred after the Tower of Babel. Although the story of the Tower of Babel isn't told until chapter 11, this is looking way beyond into the future, probably scores of generations, if not hundreds of generations later. So this is not a chronological, this is not in a chronological order with chapter 11. This is talk about after the flood, all the nations that eventually evolved out or came out came from these three sons and tells which ones came from which. But in doing so, it's taking the long view of things, which looks far beyond the Tower of Babel. And certainly at the Tower of Babel is when those languages were confused. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, I'd suggest you go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Also, tomorrow night I'm speaking in Temecula on What Are We to Make of Israel. You can find out more at the website, thenarrowpath.com.